This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening, everyone. It is Tuesday, January 29th, 2012, and we have a very special edition of our current Jewish question series. As you know from the previous classes, we try to take contemporary issues and we go through a lot of the halachic sources behind them, and usually it's a very text-based type of class. And today I wanted to do something different, partially based on some wonderful suggestions, and partially to get across that one of the themes that we do have in the current Jewish questions series is you can't just, when you're dealing with an issue of contemporary halacha, you can't just look at texts. Texts are obviously crucially important. That's how we know most of Jewish law. But you also have to know what we call the mitzvot. You have to know the reality. You have to know the facts on the ground. So as much as you might know, like, oh, here's something very theoretical, you also have to know what is the reality that you're facing. And today, we are honored in having three really astonishing, fantastic students in the Maharat program, located currently in the Upper West Side, who represent the next, perhaps first generation of Orthodox Jewish female leadership, or perhaps the destruction of Orthodox Judaism as we know it, depending on what you stand. And I brought these women here because Maharat is a fairly, partially because it's new, and partially because it's innovative, is a somewhat of a controversial institution. What it stands for, what it represents. And while we've spoken a bit in previous classes from a text-based perspective, we've never really heard what do people from Maharat actually think about what it is that they're doing as individuals. So tonight, we have no texts in front of us, no sheets, no handouts, nothing will be posted in little PDFs like that, but we do have the insights and the perspectives of three of the women who are really at the forefront of the future of Jewish or Orthodox Jewish women's leadership. And today, would like to have really an open-ended, free-flowing conversation. I'll moderate it just, to make sure that the crowd control, is handled okay. But, I just have a couple of introductory questions, and then I hope to stay out of the way unless I'll be as much of a participant as anybody else. One other final disclaimer. As per, the rules of the of my classes here, the discussion is more important than anything else. I happen to have a recording here for those who can't make it, but should anyone feel uncomfortable saying anything on the record, I almost instinctively say on tape, even though that's horribly outdated. But if no one wants to be recorded, just let me know. I'll hit pause. We'll ask the questions and things can go off the cuff. But I'd like things to be as informal and as open and as honest as anyone can be. So with that, I would like to, I guess I can introduce our three members and first ask them to talk about themselves. We have Alyssa Thomas, Rory Pickernice, and Ruth Balinski Friedman. So as an opening question, could all three of you please just say a little bit about yourselves and what brought you to Maharat?
So my name is Ruth Balinski Friedman. I'm originally from Chicago. I admit that I am the daughter of an Orthodox rabbi, so sort of grew up thinking that that was a profession that was not really within something that I would end up doing, and then it's almost embarrassing sometimes. Ended up basically doing exactly what my dad does, and I'm very grateful for the timing that Yeshivat Maharat came into existence. I was able to do that. So I went to Barnard, a while's up from here, and I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do when I graduated college in 2007, and I actually owe a lot of how I ended up at Yeshivat Maharat and Drisha to Yeshivat Chovevei Torah, which was at the time meeting in the Columbia Barnard Hillel. So while I would go to Hillel, I would like see that there was this interesting new yeshiva happening. And it seemed to be a type of Jewish mindset that I was really drawn to. And so I decided to go to Drisha. Are folks familiar with Drisha on the Upper West Side? More or less? Okay. Rabbi Silber, right, exactly. So an institute for Jewish women's education. And so they have some full-time programs. And so I went there for, at the time it was only 1 year. Actually, it sounds so cliche, but I actually walked in on the first day and thought, okay, I think I'm staying another year. It just seemed to be a place where I belonged. And towards the end of my second year, Rabbi Sarah Hurwitz had her conferral ceremony up at the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale and was welcomed as a member of their clergy staff. And they announced that Yeshivat Maharat would be opening. And so by then I had already found myself doing programs related to leadership. Programs are never entirely sure how to fill the Orthodox women's slot. You know, you can get the Reconstructionist rabbi and the Reform and the Conservative. And then with Orthodox, you get men, typically, for obvious reasons. And then, so for women, they were open to, like, Jerusha students and maybe the Stern Talmud program. And so I was already finding myself in those types of programs, so Yeshivat Maharat seemed like a really great fit. And it was.
Great. I'm Rory Pickernese. And it's always really hard for me to start off with a question of how I got to Yeshivat Maharat, because I always feel like it depends on the day and what mood I'm in to tell which story it is, right? There's always so many stories that get us to different places. I grew up in Brooklyn. I still live in Brooklyn, in a pretty traditional household, and I have three brothers, all of whom learn in Kollel, and my husband likes to joke that my parents have four kids who just learn in Kollel all day. So sometimes I think that it was just, you know, this sort of cliche, right, you have your cliche story, and mine is, you know, me keeping up with my brothers. So we all had very good day school education, and I was always, you know, really very active in terms of, you know, going to shul and participating in things, but could never really do as much as I wanted to do in terms of keeping up with them. Although it was something that bothered me on some level, but wasn't something I was necessarily conscious about. And when I went to college, I went to Hunter College on the Upper East Side, and I had intentionally chosen Hunter because I wanted something that was a little bit more diverse. And my parents had always been very open-minded people, always really encouraged us to meet different people, to be open-minded. And so I went to Hunter wanting to get a little more experience and was really shocked to realize that for as much as I had always been really open and you know, putting myself in different experiences, my experiences were ultimately incredibly limited because my resources were really limited. I went to an all-girls day school. There was only so much that my Brooklyn upbringing introduced me to. And so I actually became really fascinated in interfaith. Most of my friends that I met were of other religious traditions, and I started to study religion. And in some ways, it was really backwards, because in studying other religions, I started to study a lot more about Judaism. I graduated from college. I started to work for an organization that did interfaith work called Religions for Peace. And the organization worked with religious leaders in all different religious communities. First of all, there was not a lot of Orthodox representation in interfaith. And second of all, it became also very apparent that I was about to hit a glass ceiling incredibly quickly because I could not become ordained clergy. And so that became sort of just a personal question for me, not even so much on an emotional level for me, so much as a professional level for me, right? Where do I go from here? Do I get a PhD? But that still wasn't what people were doing. So as part of my own journey, I started working for JOFA and sort of, you know, kind of exploring some questions of women's leadership. Actually left JOFA to go back into interfaith. And somewhere along the way, I realized that for as much as I was kind of teaching and representing Judaism, I didn't really have the knowledge that I needed to do that. So I also decided to go to Drisha. I had applied to go to Drisha to learn a little bit more, to learn how to actually read the sources. And while I was applying for Drisha, they had announced the opening of Maharat. And I thought, well, this is great because here's an opportunity to balance both the learning that Drisha is able to give me with also a recognized title, because I wanted to be able to function within the community and in some kind of recognized role, and also the focus on professional development as well. And so I'll leave it at that as how I first started off there, and that's how I kind of found Maharat.
My name is Alyssa Thomas. My story is somewhat similar and somewhat a lot different. I grew up as the child of a rabbi, but my mom was the Reform rabbi. So I grew up in Los Angeles. I also lived in Dallas, Texas for a short period of time. But the truth was that though my mom is a Reform rabbi, our home was what she called Reformadox. So in terms of belief and in terms of practice, it was very much so Orthodox, but in terms of really essentially social progressive ideas, we weren't Reformed for that matter. So also, you know, if you think about it, my mother was in a generation where she was also the first group of women being ordained. Conservative wasn't happening then. So my mom kind of charted her own path. So I grew up in that household, and when I was in high school, I, you know, realized my calling to become, at the time, I would have said rabbi. And this, you know, this for me was something I knew. It never changed. This was in 10th grade. I made that decision. But I went to Brandeis University, and at Brandeis, I realized that with my Reformadox upbringing, I actually wasn't a Reform individual at Brandeis. So my religious journey sort of began there. As to what, how to articulate my religiosity, my identity, and really how my observance and beliefs worked with the fact that I knew that I was a woman who wanted to go into religious leadership in the community. So I actually sought out to study both at Neve Yerushalayim, which is ultra-Orthodox, and I also studied at Pardes, Machon Pardes, which is in Jerusalem as well, which is more so like modern Orthodox, basically. So I studied both at both of those places, and out of there, I realized that I needed to sort of also chart my own path in a way of, like Ruth was saying, and like Roy was saying, following her brothers, following whatever role model that was, and for me, that was really my mother. So what I actually ended up doing, because I had not yet heard of Yeshivat Maharat, was I thought I would go learn, get the education I needed at JTS, at the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, and got the rabbinical learning there. But as you can imagine, once I got there, I was not a conservative Jew. And while it was an amazing education, you know, something like Maharat was a better fit. So I was incredibly blessed, Baruch Hashem, that Maharat fell into my path. Because, and I was just telling Rory and Ruth this on the way over here, I am incredibly happy at Maharat. I'm finally really able to be myself. You know, unapologetically be my religious self, and also, you know, follow the professional path that I have always felt was something that God gave me the gift to do. So that's how I ended up in Maharat, and I'm a first year.
Thank you. So let's first open up to questions.
How do you feel about shuls that have partnership minyanim as opposed to
Orthodox?
You can go for another one.
Oh, you want me to go first?
Oh, no.
Oh, you don't all have
to. Right, yeah. We have opinions. Not to worry.
Don't worry, we have opinions.
Yeah. it's something that's actually, I actually grapple with that question, personally. And they're sort of turning to me because I'm involved in a partnership minion, so to speak. But it's still something that I actually really grapple with. And in part because I think in some ways it's very representative of a lot of the other things that we're trying to do, of trying to balance out the halacha with wanting to give people access to something that seems meaningful for them, and at the same time also recognizing a sense of communal norms, so to speak. And I think that there's certain things that we all have some kind of gut reaction to. There's things that the Orthodox community just doesn't do. And so I think that...
Give me an example.
We don't have women rabbis.
state of being, it's not a thing that you do.
I would argue that it might be something
not
that you do, but
succeeding
in a shul, right? There's certain things that are just... you know, things that you just don't see. It's just not Orthodox, right? As soon as people hear it, you know, the reaction is just sort of, that's just not Orthodox. And so I think the term partnership minyan is something that has become very broad and has incorporated a lot of different levels of practice and a lot of different things. And so I think that it would be an incredibly long time to discuss each individual part of davening and talk about, you know, how we feel about each part of it. But I would really say that for me, I think it plays an interesting role in creating a dialogue within the community that's trying to recognize that there is a space for women, and that women want to have more participation in ritual and don't want to just be left on the sidelines, and that there's a way that that conversation can happen halachically. How that might come down in terms of, you know, Kabbalat Shabbat versus Torah reading versus Kaddish versus, you know, that could be a whole other conversation. But I do think that it has played a really important role in raising that conversation and in recognizing that desire of women to really participate fully and to really feel that own connection to davening that had not been an opportunity that existed before.
I can ask a question back to the Maharat thing. And this is a question that's actually I've been thinking about for a while now. You all mentioned about wanting to go into Jewish leadership professionally. So what does the title Maharat do and what does that mean for you? And also, what do you expect to be able to do specifically with this title?
That's about three questions.
Yeah.
I'm a rabbi.
I'm happy to start the answer if you guys want to know to. I can say, personally, coming from a world where rabbi, it was a title, Maharat, when I first heard it, which stands for, as I'm sure most of you already know, but I'll say it, Manhiga Hilchatit Ruchanit Toranit. So for me, Manhiga, sorry, I've been saying so much, it seems second nature now. So Manhiga, so a leader, Hilchatit, halachasist, someone who can paskin, Ruchanit, spiritual leader, Toranit, teacher of Torah. So for me, when I first heard that title, my immediate response was like, that's exactly what I want to do. All those four things, that's exactly what I want to do. So in terms of the title itself, I very much so identify with it. But I think in general, those of us in Maharat, and you guys can add to this, care much more about the work that we're doing as opposed to the title that we're getting, which I think is indicative of the fact that we're at Maharat, and as much as we believe in the title, I think it's most important for us to do the Jewish leadership that you were indicating where we were getting at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sounds good. In terms of more...
well, thank you.
Yes, we're going to be very good not just to just repeat what everyone else says. Just in more in terms of the practical element of what are folks actually going to do with this title. So I'm in my last year, so I'm God willing graduating in June. And it's the first graduating class, so we actually have no actual precedent set for us yet of how to apply to jobs or where to apply to jobs. But we are looking at synagogues, hillels, perhaps day schools. You know, there are only a few, for example, high schools in the country that have women teaching Gemara. Women often, you know, are in positions of teaching like Tanakh or... things like that or Hebrew, but not really Gemara. That's still the one area where some schools are uncomfortable with the women teaching. So I think that would also be a huge step. And so just different positions within Jewish education and Jewish leadership. We have the goal really being just to have us doing what we love to do and also having women in any kind of positions of leadership, because I think in many ways we really also need more role models for younger generations as well.
Yeah. Okay, so this is sort of a double question. A question in two parts. So given that the Jewish world, the halachic world, is really politicized and often comes down to my rabbi can beat up your rabbi. how do you think that a Maharat is going to fare politically when somebody is asked, where did you get that psak? And their response begins with Maharat. Chances are, in a lot of situations, they're going to be cut off. So that's question number one. Actually, you know what? Let's just think about that.
So I think it's a great question. Let me start by saying that it's hard to really know the answer to that because we haven't really been formally out in the community, because none of us are, you know, a lot of us have internships and a lot of us are functioning in our own communities in various ways. And so I don't think that any of us have, you know, given any sock, although we've definitely helped people along and answered questions and sort of served as advisors to people. And for the most part, it's a somewhat self-selecting group. So the people who are going to come to us initially to ask us a question know that they're coming to a Maharat. And most of the people who do that do it because they want to come to a Maharat, because they think we're going to understand their situation a little bit better, because it's a little bit less embarrassing for them to talk to us, because they feel a little bit more comfortable trying to explain it to us, or whatever the situation might be. And truth be told, most of us, and I imagine, I think your situation has probably been similar, Ruth, have never, rarely, I should say, ever answered a question without stopping and conferring with a lot of other colleagues. I think especially kind of this early on in our career. So while their answer is coming sort of through a Maharat, by the most part, it's really through this whole kind of conglomeration of other people and colleagues, and a lot of them being male rabbis that we're dealing with. But I would also say that most of the time, at least now, the questions that I'm getting are not questions that anybody is then turning and saying, oh, but a Maharat told me. Usually they're incredibly personal issues that they're more than happy to talk to us about, that we'll try to help guide them through, that we'll sort of, oftentimes I don't just give them an answer, I'll go through some of the sources with them and I'll tell them how I got to that answer. And I don't think that any of them go back to their rabbi and say, here's the answer I got. I think most of them just feel like at least somebody understood and somebody answered, and sort of just go on with their lives. That's not really an answer to your question, because the point is that that's still a real reality that you raise. Somebody might do that. Somebody might mention where they got an answer, and that might be dismissed. And that's true, I think, of any rabbi. Just like you said, you know, in that kind of political world. And so I don't know how we're going to be received broadly, and I think some of it's going to be just a test of practice on the ground, that at some point we're going to be out there, people are going to actually get to know us, and they're going to choose to respect our opinions or not respect our opinions, and they'll hear our answers and agree or disagree, and that will be the real test.
I also want to add to that, I think, you know, that there is a hope that, you know, with what we're doing, it will eventually become accepted, that there will be somewhat of a norm of the Maharat. I think that's a dream far in the future, but nevertheless, I think it is important to hold on to the hope when we're doing something that is very new. You know, I also think that a psak being given is going to have a bunch of sources behind it. So, you know, someone says, oh, that's a Maharat, but really it's a Rosh and it's, you know, a Rambam, and there's other material there that we may have brought. So while, yes, our voices can be invalidated, you know, we're still going to raise them, and we're still going to engage in the halakhic dialogue.
I can also just add one last thing, that I teach Kala classes in areas around New York, also specifically Washington Heights, so classes to women and couples who are engaged and want to learn the laws of pick your favorite term, ritual purity, menstrual purity, the laws of how to prepare for that. And I actually worried, because I was worried that people would figure out Agodishi about Maharat and no one would want to take classes with me, but I've actually found that that's not true at all, and so that's always really nice. And I actually get questions sometimes from friends who I would not expect necessarily to come to me. I think you've probably found that as well. And so I think that's just, even though it's a snippet and it's confined to a certain topic, and a topic that is automatically more female-friendly in most instances, I still have found, like, been very pleasantly surprised by how welcoming that was.
That's a very good point. For most of the questions that you get that just involve opening up Shulchan Aruch, it's the same Shulchan Aruch everyone else will. But, I think, if the concern politically comes in terms of halachic deviations would be if Maharat start taking on radically new Piskei Halach and Chidushim that no one else did before. I think that's when the real dissension, like, came between Orthodox and Conservative, there was always some competition, but once they started saying, hey, we can do our own Pesach Halach and don't need to ask you anymore, they're like, oh, now we actually have real, you know, now we've got a fight on our hands. So, you know, when that comes, let us know. Any questions out here? Thoughts?
When?
Yeah.
I guess on your last point, I was curious about the, let's say, connection between, like, the Yo'etzet Halacha movement and the Maharat. I'm pretty new to, let's say, the whole Maharat movement, very interested and curious, but have heard a bit more about the Yo'etzet movement. And is that, intertwined? Is that separate? Like, what's sort of the relationship between the two?
So the Halakha program, just for folks who may not be familiar, is a program based in Israel, though they are bringing it to the United States, in which women study all the laws of Nida, of menstrual purity, intensively for a few years. I mean, really, really intensively. And then they go out and they work with communities. The idea being that relying on the male rabbi to answer questions that are sensitive to the female body and emotions is sometimes difficult for a lot of women, and a lot of women were not asking questions. And if you have a yotzet halakha, translates literally to a halakhic advisor present who... she can help guide you through those answers, and also for the questions that she does not know the answer to, refer to the rabbi. So in some cases, to serve as the woman that, as the person that the women with questions go to, or as the middle woman to the rabbi, so that women with sensitive questions do not have to necessarily just approach a male rabbi that they may not know so well. So the programs have absolutely no official affiliation whatsoever. I happen to coordinate the Yotze Halakha of Washington Heights, but that's just a coincidence. But I would say that, you know, we're all part of this very, very broad movement of thinking about how to include women in more positions of leadership. Also, you know, I think what both our school and the Yotze Halakha program do is also recognize that there is a need within the Orthodox community for female leadership specifically. It's not just about putting women out there, it's also about recognizing the need, right, that there is for that.
I would actually say that I think, personally, I have a tremendous amount of hakarat hatov to the Yoetzet movement, sort of, as you call it, because I think that it's actually been a really interesting frame. I think it's like a really important, in some ways, precursor to Maharat. Not to say that we're, you know, the evolution of them, but certainly when I try to talk to people about Maharat and what it is that we're doing, very often, at least in my own community, people will say, oh, like a Yuetzet Halakha. And it's sort of like the first low-hanging fruit, right? Like, most women think that it makes perfect sense that they could ask these intimate, you know, like, bodily marital questions to another woman who would understand what they're saying and either be able to open up the Shulchan Aruch themselves or at least ask their question to a rabbi, and they don't have to have this embarrassment of going to the rabbi face-to-face. So I think that that's a huge step forward. I think that Maharat has a similar idea behind it, but our focus is not only on specifically Nida. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that we could do the same thing also for Shabbat, for Kashrut, Avelut, life cycle events, the focus on pastoral counseling, which is obviously also integral when someone's coming to you with any other question, but that is a specific part of our curriculum. Mm-hmm. So I think that Maharat has sort of expanded that notion a lot, but I think that the Yoetzet Halakha program has certainly been a huge inroads for us in terms of kind of warming the community to that idea.
Mm-hmm. Want to go? So actually, that gives me a second question. I'll ask my first question first. Turning actually more to the personal, like from your introductions, because it's actually striking, you all have very diverse family backgrounds. What's been the reaction of your family to your chosen career path and, you know, institution of choice? And just to even add to that a little bit, just the reactions among your own peer group, like among your own friends, you choosing to do something very different.
So my mother was, I mean, she's thrilled. She's thrilled because I'm following my own truth, and that's something that my mother very much so values. She also is my role model, as I said before. I think in terms of, like, my friends, for instance, when I was at JTS for that year, everyone was like, oh, Alyssa, you know, you're not, like, you're Orthodox, you're not supposed to be here. You know, so this makes perfect sense.
Sorry, I didn't hear that over here.
Oh, sorry, I was turning, but sorry, I'll speak more broadly. So I was saying, when I was at JTS, all of my peers, when I told them I was transferring, were, you know, they all responded, Alyssa, this is obviously where you were supposed to be. You're not, you know, you don't really belong here. One of my Gemara teachers was like, you know, I always wondered how we were going to make it in the conservative movement because you don't think like a conservative do. So, you know, I got a lot of positive feedback just in terms of following my own path. But also, I think, you know, I live in the Upper West Side, and I mean, I was saying before, I lived in Stuytown for a short period of time too, but I live in the Upper West Side, and pretty much everyone I encounter, at least on the Upper West Side, is very supportive of Maharat, but that's also indicative of the Upper West Side mentality, as we can imagine. But really, I think in general, I'm very blessed to have a family that's very proud of me and supportive of me. You know, and I'm also blessed because I have a mother who can emulate that for me.
My family doesn't quite know what to do with me. I'm not sure that really changed when I went to Maharat or not. I don't think I was such a black sheep, but I don't think, like, I think I always sort of, you know, kind of went my own path in some ways. We don't talk about it a lot. We sort of just kind of avoid the topic. So like I said, I have three brothers. They all also kind of react a little bit differently. So one will just never talk about it. One every once in a while will come by and look at my bookshelf and say, "I don't own those books." And one of them actually will kind of randomly email me, like, obscure Sfarim and say, "Have you ever heard of this?" Which I like to think is his way of bonding, you know? You know, I mean, my parents overall, I think, you know, generally kind of try to be supportive, you know, and my mom is kind of, like, really open about talking about it, probably even more so than I am. So I live, I don't know how well people know Brooklyn, but I live in the kind of Flatbush Midwood area, which is not, you know, where most people expect to find a Maharat student. And so it's been really interesting kind of for in some ways for me personally of how do I actually talk about it. And so when I go back to a wedding of a high school classmate or whatever it is, you know, and people say, "What are you up to?" And I'll sort of say, like, "Oh, I'm in a learning program." You know, I sort of try to think, like, safe things, right? Like, you know, learning Torah, that's a good thing, right? You know, and then, so it's been kind of in my own journey of being comfortable enough and confident enough to tell people more about it. But what's been really actually fascinating for me is that for as much as I probably spent the first 2 years at Maharat not telling people what I was doing and trying to make it sound really safe, as people have learned what I've been doing, even people who I've overheard in the broader community sort of mocking it as they were reading about it in the Jewish Week or kind of engaging in the debate, there was this sort of reaction on the one hand of, "Oh, that makes sense. Oh, Rory could be good at that. That could, you know, that could be interesting." And I think this personalization of what it is that we're doing, and that's something that I think is something that a lot of us in the broader program have experienced, that the debate about Maharat has by and large been in the newspapers, it's been among, you know, kind of rabbis, it's been among, you know, whatever, the RCA, you know, whoever it is that you want to be. But for the most part, when you actually meet us, like, look at it. Like, we're not, you know, very overwhelming individuals, I think. I don't know, you could all disagree with me if you're intimidated by us. And so I think that it's been really interesting where people who were sort of really opposed to it, when they sort of knew me personally, were kind of a little bit like, "Oh, okay, I can... That's not as scary as I thought it was going to be. That's not sort of the image I had in my mind." And more I'll have people in my own community who will come over to me and say, "So what are we learning this week? What Gemara are we up to? Like, what's going on?" I've got, like, my own guy in the bookstore who's like, "Tor Shulchan Aruch, Rambam, like, what are we up to now?" You know, and so it's been really actually great for me to see that for the most part, I think it's been something that, as I've been able to just have those personal relationships with people, has been a very positive reaction, even when I'll kind of overhear the broader community still being like, "I don't really know what that's about."
Yeah. So I'll go backwards a little bit because I think that's, like, such an important point to make. Some of my friends are more, I guess I would say, politically, religiously aligned with Yeshiva Maharat and are therefore very supportive. A lot of my friends I know are not, and I know would not necessarily be supportive of the institution by any means, but also, what I tell people, and folks seem genuinely surprised oftentimes by that, is I've really never been met face-to-face with opposition. That's something I think really speaks well to the Orthodox community. We love to fight on paper and on blog posts, but when it comes to we do without the emails. But really, when it comes to face-to-face, I find people are very respectful
Save for one incident I had in Lithuania with the chief rabbi, who did not really seem to fully get what I was doing. But that's okay. He spoke only to my husband the whole time. but that really, like, I say that because it's kind of funny, but it also is really the only example. And that wasn't, it wasn't negative opposition, it was just sort of like, I don't really think you're... it was very doubtful of what we were actually doing. And so to echo that also, and then I'll end with family, the rabbi of my synagogue in Washington Heights is a rabbi at Yeshiva University, and is not necessarily a supporter per se of Yeshivat Maharat, but is always extremely respectful and nice. And there was once an incident in which someone voiced some frustration that I was speaking at the shul, and he said, no, like, I actually value your presence, like, I basically have no problem with you being here. And that's something I'm very, very grateful for as well. And to end with family, I mean, I sort of have the most boring of the three. My dad, the Maran Orthodox rabbi, gets into many fights of the RCA in the RCA listserv about women's stuff. He's on the advisory board of Yeshivat Maharat. And so, thankfully, I have a family that's very supportive. I guess I would say the biggest supporter actively is my 17-year-old sister, who is a senior in high school and constantly fighting her teachers at her Orthodox school to be more inclusive of women, just got herself to be the first girl in her high school to light the Hanukkah menorah at the end of school every day. When it was dress up as a Jewish hero day instead of going as Esther, because that's really the only option for girls, she went as Rabbatzar Harlot. So in some ways it's funny because, you know, we try to purposely focus on the work that we do and not fight those battles as much, but she's really on the front lines of that one, so it's very fun to see.
That is you?
Right.
Jamie.
I guess sort of on that point, I went to Torah Academy and Girls High in Philly, which is a very interesting school. I'm not from an Orthodox background, so they didn't really know what to do with me. And I guess coming from an experience which did not have a female rabbi, had some very strong female role models, but I guess what is sort of the trajectory for reaching out to young Orthodox women who, let's say, in high school, particularly, let's say, Balat Tshuva or girls who just don't fit the mold for, like, what is there, like, plans for a high school? Is there plans for, please open a high school? I'm so nervous for, like, any future daughters I have. I'm like, I don't know where to send them. but, like, it was, as you probably know, it's, like, it's very tough to be sort of your independent mind in these Orthodox high schools. And to, I guess, is that discussed at all? Like, are there plans, or what's moving forward, let's say, with that?
We don't necessarily have any concrete plans to target any specific population at the moment. Mm-hmm. I happen to, like I mentioned earlier, very, very strongly value the presence of Orthodox women in day schools. I mean, I know that... certainly, while my teachers in high school knew stuff, if any conversation went tangential, it was about shaitzels, you know, and hair coverings and all those things, they're important to talk about. But also, it tends to be that I think the role model that many of my female teachers was really like the more material component of it. And I think it's really important to maintain role models for serious Torah leadership as well. I've actually taught in the Drisha Summer High School program for 3 summers, which I don't know, it basically draws the types of girls that exactly who you're talking about, the girls who think, like, I'd love to spend 5 weeks learning Torah for 12 hours a day. Yes! and so they come from both Israel and the States, and I have to say that they were really excited about Yeshivat Maharat. In the summer, Rabbatzar Harlot happened to be in the building one day, and I said, if you have an extra minute, please just come into my class, you can just walk right in, don't worry about it. And she did, she walked in, and I introduced her, and the girls were like, oh! Somebody was like literally a celebrity. And so I think there's like a lot of really terrific energy there, and I'd love for us as we grow an institution to find a way to harness that and really encourage that.
I think also, I mean, something that our Rosh Hashiva, Reb Jeffrey Fox, has said many times, at least to me, is that, you know, the dream is that, you know, in a community, a maharat, whether that's someone working in a day school or working in a shul, in a pastoral way, whatever that may be, that will be a presence that girls grow up seeing. Mm-hmm. And so if that's something that's already there, even if it's not necessarily in a structured way in a curriculum in high school, knowing that you know, you can look to a school or to a shul and see that there's a woman in leadership, I think automatically sort of changes the mindset, that there is an opportunity that, you know, as I was seeing it when I was younger, I have to chart my own territory. My mom had to chart her own path. Not necessarily having to look at it that way at some point in the future, I think it would be the dream.
Mm-hmm. George had a question first.
From a philosophical point of view, what do you think the Rav would say, salvation? And how would you answer it?
It's like an application essay question.
You can say I don't know, by the way.
Yeah.
I do that all the time.
I feel weird speaking for Rav Salvation.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm always wary of trying to put words into other people's mouths, especially considering how many times this happened to all of us. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Tamila? Sorry, timing.
This might be ignorant. I don't know. What are sort of the rules? What if you want to call yourself Rabbah one day? Like, can you just do that? Or is it, can you do that, but it might be somewhere. And also, what about practical things like parsonage and whatever that puts on with the rabbinate?
Not an ignorant question at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great question.
Do you want? Okay, I can answer. So, in terms of our title, the general rule, which you can use the language more precisely on, is that we're being given the title Maharat for the community in which we're working, whether that's a shul, a day school, a hospital, whatever that may be, in accordance with the place that we're working, Yeshivat Maharat, and the students at Yeshivat Maharat, the title will be decided. So if, for instance, like I'm also interested in going into chaplaincy. So if I'm working in a hospital, you know, in an interfaith hospital, someone may hear Maharat and not be able to pronounce that or not know what that means, but they're much more familiar with Rabbi. So that may be something, I mean, that's not our title. Our title is Maharat, but, I mean, it's the board and the teachers in the community. Do you want to add more to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think right now we're staying, we've learned that we're staying away from Rabbi language, Rabbah language. Again, maintaining the distinction between wanting to do what is best for the program and for the Orthodox community in terms of us being able to be a presence in the broader Orthodox community. But I think, like, Alyssa's absolutely right. With the title is Maharat. However, working with the community, they would not decide for us. We would work together to decide on a title if it's more appropriate. So, for example, like working, I actually don't know anything much about hospital chaplaincy, the titles people go to, so maybe I won't speak to that specifically. But if there is a title, let's say if you were working in a school, and it could be, let's just say, Rosh Beit Midrash, because I've had a female one of those before. Something like that. So it's not saying like the title has to be Maharat so-and-so. That'll probably be the working professional title. But what we mean is that, like, within the context of what we're doing, if there's a title that better describes our role, we would be open to pursuing that as well. But we do stay away from the language of Rabbi and Rabbah for now. Yeah.
And I think just to emphasize where Alyssa had kind of started off with, I think in an earlier question, it's all about making sure that we can do the work that we want to do and not getting kind of caught up in it. And so I like to say to people that at the same time that the institution is training us, we're also training the community. And we're trying to introduce to the community that this role exists and these women exist. And so if it's going to take, you know, an hour every time you walk into a space to explain what Maharat means, then that's not doing the job that you're there to do. You know, like... Yeah, exactly. It's kind of productive. And so at the core, we're not, you know, we're looking to make sure that we can actually do what it is that we want to do, and hopefully as we're doing it, we will introduce this title of Maharat. And you know, I think that, at least for me personally, the goal is that, you know, Maharat means something, and that you do walk in and everyone understands what Maharat means. But if they don't right now, then that's not really the focus. In terms of parsonage, we would be eligible for parsonage, just like other rabbinic colleagues, which is actually, by the way, I think one of the big fundamental points in terms of Maharat, of sort of recognizing that there's a role that women have, not just in terms of the regard of the community, but just legally and monetarily. You know, we expect to not only, you know, are we having this training and want to have these roles, but we also expect to get paid and have the same benefits as everybody else who goes through the same process.
Question here, interject a little bit. Ruth mentioned something earlier about the need for Jewish female leadership. With the exception of being a role model for, you know, young Jewish girls and women, what do you say is particularly distinct about female leadership versus male leadership? Questions for everyone. It was just Ruth was one that sparked the question.
That goes with that.
Sure.
Which, I mean, Alyssa might have extra experience with it, but you can see.
You know, especially if your mother being the first generation for female form rabbis, is there anything from the experience of, you know, female leaders, and particularly female rabbis in other denominations, for how it worked in the last 20, 30 years, of lessons to learn of what worked and what didn't work, for how this would be different?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a lot to be learned from the conservative reform movements, and I think that the dialogue between Maharat and the women who were leading those journeys and those two different movements, as well as Reconstructionists, which is part of that, and Renewal, I think is crucial. And there have been times when, you know, we've been talking about pastoral care, or how to go into, you know, how to go into negotiations about the contract, or about, you know, I don't know, an example would be like maternity leave or something. You know, going into that, I think that there are a lot of women who have already charted the territory. So there are common denominators that you can definitely draw from, and that's really important. And then kind of going back to what you were saying before, I think Maharat, the leadership of a woman, specifically in the Orthodox community, though yes, there has been female leadership throughout history, whether it's, you know, Yehudit or whoever it is throughout history, I think that this is like an established official leadership, and that does make it a little bit different. So the nature of the fact that there hasn't been an official leadership in that way does make it naturally different from male leadership in to some degree. But I think, you know, what Ruth and Rory were touching on before with Kala classes and other things, I do think that there is a space where, you know, members of the community may want or need to seek out women's leadership, but I also think at the same time, while men and women are different, that there are a lot of things that are similar. And so, you know, we're going into a field where we'll be working with male rabbis, and that while Maharat is something that's distinct, or Yuat HaHalacha is also something that's distinct, while those are things that are a little bit different, as we've seen in the other movements, you know, they eventually work together, and it doesn't have to be so male versus
just
female.
Not just the professional aspect, but I think, you know, are the conservative reform communities different than they were before having women leaders? And, and, you know, and therefore, like, you know, have their communities changed by the notion of having women leaders? You know, maybe just add to that the notion that, you know, I think people have written about this, and it's not just in the Jewish world. Female spirituality is different than male spirituality. And when you add female spirituality into a community, you know, the community leaders, how is the spiritual nature of that community different from having female leaders, both positive and negative? You know, how has the community changed by having those leaders? And how do you see the Orthodox community as a community functioning differently, having the spiritual voices of women in leadership?
I think it's a hard question, you know, for me at least. Like, my own hesitation has to do with labeling, you know, this sort of grouping of kind of like male and female, you know, and I think it's something that at least for me sort of always leaves a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth to sort of say like men do this but women do this, because the truth is that I think that we're all coming to this as individuals. And you know, truth be told, if you had one shul that hired the three of us, there would be, you know, some of you would resonate with one of us and some of you would resonate better with another one of us. And you know, our teaching styles are different and our speaking style is different. And I think what we're primarily really just recognizing is that there's half of the population that we just have cut off from this role, and that there's people who would relate better to us. And I don't want to just say that because we're women, but because we're who we are. Part of that experience is being female. Part of that experience is, you know, Alyssa growing up in Los Angeles and who her mom is. You know, like, there's a whole package that makes each of us who we are. And so I know in our own experiences, you know, I have a few different internships, and each of the places that I work will say that there's some students or there's some congregants who have just clicked better with me. Maybe in part because I'm female, it's hard to really pinpoint, right, which is the aspect that somebody mm-hmm. does. Whatever it is, there's something that resonates. They just relate to me a little bit better. And there's plenty of people who aren't drawn to me and, you know, who like the rabbi or like the other Hillel professional or whatever it is, and we'll go to them for their questions. So I think in part what we're really recognizing is that it's not necessarily just because we're women, but because there's a need to introduce more of these experiences and more of these people for other people to access, and that, you know, cutting off half of the population from that is just not really worthwhile. I would say also that in the Orthodox population that has different roles for men and women, and if we are going to acknowledge that there's different roles and different expectations of men and women in the Orthodox community, then it's also pretty hard to say that the leadership only exists for one of those roles and that there's not that same access. In terms of how that plays out in other movements, I think it's also a little bit hard to compare, because I think what Maharad is doing, while certainly we look to the other movements and I think we try to learn a lot from them, I think there's something very fundamentally different about what we're doing than what the other movements are. First and foremost, I think the other movements, and I'm happy to be corrected on this, I don't claim to be a Jewish historian and speak for everybody else, most of the other movements, women's leadership was introduced primarily from the top down. So the institutions decided to accept women, and people were maybe accepting or not accepting of it. We don't necessarily, I mean, as much as Maharad is an institution, we're not, you know, there's no sort of Orthodox leadership that has announced that women are now allowed to do this. We're primarily much more grassroots, and we're trying to sort of get ourselves into the institutions from the bottom up. And the other thing is that we're trying to create a different role. And we're trying to basically say that there's another space for women. And so I do also think that I agree with everything Alyssa was saying about kind of learning from it. And like I said, I also sort of hesitate about like female spirituality versus male spirituality. I don't disagree with it. I don't really know. I don't know. I always hesitate for that kind of language. But I also do think that what Maharad is claiming to do is, you know, we're not trying to say that we're the same as men, that we're taking on the exact same roles as men, but we're basically trying to say that there's a role that we have to play in the community, and we'd like to have the opportunity to do that.
I'd like to hear a little bit about your internships, where you work and what you do, and also how many women are in the graduating class and how many are in the school, and what percentage of the faculty is male.
All great questions. So maybe we'll start working backwards. So the faculty, so Rabbi Sara is the dean. Rabbi Jeffrey Fox is our Rosh Yeshiva, and then our Gemara teacher is Devorah Slotchauer, if anyone is familiar with her. And then actually our two pastoral women, well, are both women, Aaron Lee Smokler and Dr. Esther Altman. And so, yes, I actually never really thought about it, but we do lean very heavily towards the female, but ultimately the Rosh Yeshiva is a male. The second question, how many students? We currently have 14 students, three of whom are in the graduating class. And then the first question was, internships, right. So I am currently, last year and this year, interning at the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale. And so my husband and I go there for Shabbos once a month, because like I mentioned, we live in Washington Heights. And so we do that once a month because of the geographical division. We all commute in New York, so Upper West Side to Riverdale on a regular basis would unfortunately be a bit trying. And so I'm there primarily on Shabbos.
I'm also interning this year at the GCC in Manhattan, the one on the Upper West Side. And so that's also a very interesting experience because it is working, trying to basically figure out how to communicate Jewish values to everyone who walks in the door, not in an imposing sense, but if the building is going to close for Sukkot, for example, and many of the members are either not Jewish and not heard of Sukkot, or maybe perhaps Jewish but not so affiliated or involved and also have not heard of Sukkot. So how do you create one little sheet to hand out at the door that is going to somehow explain Sukkot in a meaningful but not, like, information overload kind of way? And so those are the types of things that I work on at the GCC.
I have been interning. This is actually my third year at the Hillel at Hunter College, where I've been their, you know, sort of rabbinic intern and doing a lot of teaching and also just available to students to talk about different things. It's my second year. I seem to keep picking up internships, but I never drop any of them. So that's something I should really reflect on at some point. It's my second year interning at Beit Chaverim of Westport and Norwalk with Rabbi Yossi Pollack, who some of you may know from Stanton Street previously. I don't know. He sends regards, though, to everybody at the building. I asked him if he wanted me to send regards to the people or the building, and he said both. So I've been interning with him, and my role there has been I deliver the drasha, I teach classes, and also, again, have been available to congregants and, like I was sort of saying before, people that I've made connections with and sort of pastoral care. And this year was my first year also interning at the Hill at NYU.
I'm a first year. So I just started, but this semester I'm starting to teach a little, like, once a month at the Cornell Center for Jewish Living, which is at Cornell University in Ithaca, which is extraordinarily far away. So
we got progressively further.
So true. So I'm going to be teaching there, which, you know, I'll get more internships in the future, but that's where I am now.
Give some up as you pick up new ones. We'll talk about that.
You mentioned the word chaplaincy. How does that play?
Oh, I got this. So I'm interested in working both in the pulpit and also as a chaplain. And in addition to my studies in Maharat, I'm going to become a certified chaplain, which is 3 units of clinical pastoral education, which each unit is 400 hours. So it's a total of 1,600 hours. And then additionally, you have to do 1,000 hours of actually working, and then that's really how you get a job. So I'm doing that in addition to Maharat, and I'm extraordinarily passionate about it. I worked at Bellevue Hospital this past summer, which is why I was in Stuytown. And so that's something that we are also integrating into our program right now, in addition to what I was just saying I'm doing. This semester, there's actually a mini CPE unit happening between Maharat and Yeshivat Chovei Beit Torah. And together they're going to be doing clinical pastoral education is essentially working in process groups and going over the interactions and learning how to use certain language that's sensitive within a pastoral context of chaplaincy while also couching it in religious language and learning how to do that. So this semester, it's going to be at
Columbia
Presbyterian.
So chaplaincy training is it's all the same. In other words, if you're a chaplain in the army, or you're a chaplain in a hospital, or you're a chaplain in a hospice, it's all the same.
In terms of being called a chaplain, like a certified chaplain, you can get the training in any of those fields, but people generally go into one or another.
Military is slightly different.
Military is slightly different. Like, you need to be able to, like,
you
specialize
actually,
in that.
And you also have to
and
do,
you have to do
you
basic
actually,
training.
You also do basic training.
Yeah, and you have to do basic training.
That sounds
yeah.
Which
yeah.
by the way, just interestingly.
And they get rid of your loans.
They actually, each of the branches of military service have their own chaplaincy training program.
Right. And, well, I have to say, actually, interestingly, because if you want to talk also about kind of men and women, military chaplaincy is very interested in more women, especially Jewish
yeah.
military chaplaincy. But this is actually something I've personally looked into. My understanding is that to commit to military chaplaincy, you have to commit to not getting pregnant for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also something very interesting for
soldiers don't have to commit to that, you know.
Well, so it becomes very interesting.
It
would
be incredibly hard.
No, so I'm saying so that's also, you know, kind of, you want to talk about sort of, you know, the different roles of men and women and things that we're facing, especially I think like for all of us sitting here who are in our 20s. Hmm?
I feel like that's a core challenge waiting to happen.
Yeah,
that's not
legal. Things are legal in the military that would never be legal.
I was going to say, if anybody wants to take that on, we can talk more about it. But it's something that I sort of looked into and was sort of like a talk to you in a few years kind of,
Do you know if that's true across all branches of service?
I don't know. I specifically had looked into the Navy. I think it's true also in the Army. I mean, I think there is some kind of... first of all, because you have to also go through basic training, then you definitely can't be pregnant at that time.
That's only 4 weeks.
And then I think... I think it has to do, though, with some kind of level in terms of... depending on your commitment. I can't speak concretely about all of it, but I do know that at least in some branches of military, that's true. Which is very different for men and women.
Okay, so here's the flip side of the other question. Do you anticipate that people may come to you because they're sock shopping and hope to get the most lenient answer from you, because you obviously, I mean, I'm being sarcastic about that, but you obviously are going to be the most lenient.
I've had people, so far, I have not had anybody come to me to sock hop.
Sock hop, that's great.
I am... copyright pending. It's on the recording, right? I'll read it here first. So, at least to my... that's going to be my legacy now. I should just say nothing more. So that at least hasn't been my experience. There has been people who have come to me because, somebody said to them, like, oh, you have to, do this or talk to this rabbi, or, someone sort of sent them and they've sort of said, like, this is just too embarrassing, I think some of it's also just kind of very personal to us. I am not somebody who's looking to be make-all just to be make-all. I'm not looking to give lenient answers just to give leniency. I think that, I don't think that our program is training us to do that. I think that what we're all really training to do is to understand the halacha, but also to really understand what the questions behind the questions are, how to really understand the full question of what's going on. And so, when you're coming with whatever question it is, usually the simplest questions are, I just don't know the answer to this, right? Like, it's straightforward, I did X, Y, and Z, and now I don't know, like, if my spoon is kosher or not, right? So there's always the straightforward things. But when people are coming with sort of these, like, real questions, there's always a lot more at play behind the questions. And really what we're trying to do is to really sort of, like, pastor to the whole person and kind of answer to the whole person. And so within that, I think that's what people are going to be really drawn to. And I think sometimes in finding out more of the information, there might be more room to then be lenient. And that's something that I know, at least when I'm teaching Kala classes, it's something that I always try. I know that a lot of the people I teach come to me with questions. A lot of them don't. And so the biggest thing I try to tell them is give as much information as possible. Because if you ask this question, people might say this, but you don't know that all of these other things are actually relevant, right? People don't necessarily ask you the follow-up questions. But we're really going to ask the follow-up questions. And so I think that that's also something that if people come to us because they just assume we're going to be lenient, they might be disappointed. But I hope people come to us because we're really looking to talk to them and understand what it is that they're facing.
There are no more questions. I think we've been at this for an hour. Yeah. So thank you all very much for coming down. This is really fantastic. Oh,
yeah,
it was
lovely.
Really our pleasure. And I'm sorry, there's one more disclaimer. I'm sorry I didn't say at the beginning that all the opinions here represent the individuals. No one is officially speaking for Maharat, but people are going to make whatever assumptions they are anyway. Again, thank you. This is really spectacular. And thank you.
Thank
and feel free to come down for a regular Shabbos, too. We're open. You all.